and welcome to Season 14, Episode 2 of the Ubuntu Podcast. My name's Mark, and joining me this week are Martin.
Hello.
And Alan.
Good day.
And in this show, we're going to be talking about smart TVs. One smart TV in particular, mine. We'll have some command line love, and we'll go over the mountains and mountains of feedback we've had while we were away. In the meantime, Martin, what have you been up to recently?
I have been rediscovering Keybase.io.
Wow, I have never discovered Keybase.io in the first place. What is it?
It's many things, but it's brilliant. So I first started using it about 4 years ago to do sort of identity verification. You can upload your GPG keys and then you can follow some prompts to put text records in your DNS entries for your website to prove you own a website, or tweet a specific thing to prove that your Twitter account belongs to you. And you can do the same across different social networks and things like, you know, Reddit and Hacker News and all the rest of it. And that's how I started using it. But since then, it's like public private key cryptography for normal people. And I put myself in that because I've never been able to actually like do that well. And it does, you know, encrypt and decrypt files, but it has fully private encrypted file synchronization. So think Dropbox, but fully encrypted file repositories, fully encrypted end-to-end chat, and private encrypted Git repositories. And it was discovering that it had that really got me interested. And what I've done is I use a tool called Yadim, which is my dot file manager, which uses Git as its back end, and I have moved my Yadim stuff into a private encrypted Keybase Git repository. So I now have fully private encrypted dot file management, and it's ace.
I also set up Keybase and did all the identity verification, and I added friends of people that I knew online, and I would get emails from them saying, this person you follow on Twitter is also on Keybase, you could connect to them. And I went through all the dance every time. And then after a while, I thought, I'm not actually using this for anything at all. And in fact, in more recent years, they added some crypto nonsense to it. And I started getting DMs from random people asking me to do stuff in order to for them to get some crypto nonsense from me. And that made me so angry, I just completely removed it, because it just completely degraded any trust I had in that system. And so I absolutely do not trust Keybase one step at all.
Interesting. So I noticed that they introduced that Lumens, I think it is the crypto, I think it's a cryptocurrency.
It's crypto nonsense.
It's a blockchain thing. I'm not there for that. But I did see some of those DMs back a couple of years ago from randos trying to, you know, milk, you know, cryptocurrencies out of you. But I think they've managed that now, because I've not seen any evidence of that happening in recent times at all.
Weren't they bought by Zoom?
They were acquired by Zoom, yeah.
That was at the beginning of last year when it started getting popular.
Right, yeah. And the other thing that I've been using it for is we have a thing called the Ubuntu Mate Guardians, who are a small group of people that basically have access to everything that is the infrastructure of Ubuntu Mate, you know, the encryption keys, the server keys, the SSH keys, everything. And we are now using Keybase as the means to store that and exchange those secrets in an encrypted way just between those people that should have access to that. So I really like it, despite its slip-ups with cryptocurrencies in the past. Alan, what have you been doing?
I've been blogging.
No way.
I know, right?
Have you indeed?
Yeah, I've been blogging like it's 1999.
You really have.
I started on WordPress many years ago. Well, no, I started long before that on a website with front page extensions. But more recently, I used WordPress, and then I switched to Nicola, and I didn't manage to keep the blogging going. I found the workflow a little bit frustrating. But recently, last year, I switched from Nicola to Hugo as a static site generator. And I found that so much more pleasant to use. Not that there's anything wrong with Nicola or any of the other static site generators, but I really like Hugo. And I've managed to crank out a blog post every day since December the 17th or something like that.
Wow.
Which is quite a lot.
I know this to be true because while we do our research for this here podcast, one of the things I do is go and look at planetubuntu.com in order to go and see what's going on in the community. And I read something and it says Alan Pope title. And then I read the next thing. And then the next thing is Alan Pope something. And then I read the next story and then it's Alan Pope. And then it's Alan Pope. And then it's Alan again.
So I am on a one-man crusade to try and encourage other people to blog by pushing me off of various planets and RSS readers, you see.
Right.
In fact, Andy Smith, who runs Bitfolk, who very kindly hosts our VPS for this podcast, he recently sent an email to the Bitfolk users mailing list saying, oh, I've refreshed the Bitfolk planet instance. Could you all start blogging again, please, and let me know your RSS feeds? If nothing, to drown out it just being Planet Alan. And so, yeah, and that has worked, actually. John the Nice Guy has started blogging a little bit more. Brilliant. As well. So actually, my foolhardy plan to dominate the world of blogging is working because it's causing other people to start blogging as well, which is good.
And how are you finding it, actually keeping it up a blog a day?
It can be tough. Sometimes it just something comes to me. There's the odd occasion where I'm sat staring at a blank page thinking, what am I going to write about? So I've cheated a couple of times and revived an old blog post. And on most of the time, I can think of something to write. Some of them have been quite well received. I've had three or four of them that have hit the front page of Hacker News. One of them stayed there for 12 hours and was quite popular in loads of comments. So that was quite good. That was quite satisfying that other people enjoyed the content. So yeah, it's good fun. I enjoy it. It's a nice creative outlet.
Gonna have to ding you for saying content though.
And with that, let's get on with the show. Now, while we were off air, I decided that I needed a new TV because my old TV, I didn't buy, it was given to me and it was showing its age a bit. I discovered that old TVs did something called overscanning, where the picture goes off the edge of the screen, which is fine if you're watching a broadcast and an analog broadcast and the sides are all fuzzy. But if you've got an HDMI thing plugged in and it's a PC and you want the nice crisp edges of what's on your screen to show, it's a pain. Also, the sound was going. Also, it wasn't full HD and a number of other things, which meant it was time for a refresh. Now, I've not bought what I would consider a big TV before, and I've been really resistant to this for quite a while because nowadays, if you're buying a big TV, it has to be a smart TV. Right. It has to have an OS running on the TV, which provides, you know, internet connectivity and streaming features and stuff. And what I've always done up till now is my TV has been a monitor and then the smartness I bring along with something else.
So just to segue with that, my plasma telly that is in the front room was purchased.
Plasma was purchased
in 2004. And it is actually an industrial plasma unit that's designed to be hung in airports or, you know, whatever to, you know, display timetables because I didn't want speakers or tuners or anything. I just wanted a dumb screen because like you, I wanted all of the clever bits to be outside of the screen itself.
Yes.
So is it difficult buying a non-smart TV?
Yes. Essentially, you either have to do what Martin did and get some sort of digital sign from a digital signage company. The alternative I found was you can try and buy a really big computer monitor. The trouble is, if you try and buy a really big computer monitor, they're curved because they're designed for one person sitting at a computer desk. They're not designed for a family sitting in a living room. And so, yeah, you get above about 30 inches and they're curved and it's really hard to find anything else.
Or you can find really big flat ones, but they are the cost of a family car.
So what convinced me to change my ways and actually buy a smart TV was that the device that I've been using to provide the smartness more recently has been a Roku. So I've got a couple of Rokus, one in on our TV in the bedroom, and there's been one in the living room, and they've been very well received by the family, very well received by me, in that they are, you know, a neat device that just does give me the apps to stream stuff and don't be annoying and don't have a terrible UI and keep getting updates and things like that. And I can buy them in Argos. And then another thing I found in Argos was a Roku TV. So there's a company called Hisense that have now made TVs which use Roku OS as their OS.
Huh.
So they do a range. I think there's three different sizes you can get. I went for the smallest one, which is 43 inches. That's small.
That's small. My gosh. Is this like phones?
Yeah.
Small phones are 6-inch screens now. Holy cow.
How did you arrive at this one? Was it just you stumbled looking through all the TVs and you saw Roku in the list of operating systems and thought, ah, this might be a game changer for me because I like Roku?
I think that was it, yes.
Right.
I became aware while I was thinking this TV's awful and I have to replace it eventually and thinking I'm really dreading looking for a TV. At the same time, I became aware that Roku TVs were a thing. And so I started looking into them and trying to work out if the actual TV itself was any good, aside from the fact that it was running a Roku OS. And I got the impression that actually, for the price that you pay for them, they're pretty good TVs. So I thought it was worth a go.
I mean, I have a smart TV, mm-hmm. but I don't use any of the smarts that are in it because it's got a set-top box underneath it from my cable provider.
Right.
And I don't care that it's a smart TV because there's nothing in there that I use. It automatically comes onto HDMI 1, which is the box that's underneath. Is there anything like in a smart TV that like really properly gets in the way if you just have an external HDMI input these days? Mine is a little bit old, to be fair.
Well, my concern is that a lot of the smart TVs I'd seen or I'd used in other places, the UI for doing things was pretty bad. It seemed like it was sort of a case of, you know, the company decided that they needed smarts in their TV, so they just bought whatever they could and bunged it on there. I wouldn't have had a lot of confidence that it would get updates because, you know, I don't know who's making this software.
But that's my point. Why do you care? If you're never going to use the UI other than for the initial setup, scan for channels or, you know, rename the HDMI input so it's called set top box or something. Why does it matter what the TV UI looks like? Because you're never going
to
see it.
But I'd still have to use it if I needed to do any of, you know, if I needed to switch inputs or if I needed to change the settings on the TV and things like that.
Right. Okay.
And I'd have all of this other stuff running on the TV, which I paid for and wasn't using. And that would annoy me. The fact that it had this whole operating system with all of these apps, which I had to buy, that would really, really irk me to know that I'd had to do that because that was the only option.
Fascinating.
So just coming back to Roku OS, I find this very interesting. So I've been using Rokus for years. We've got them on everything that is a screen in the house, and we have done for, I think, as long as Rokus have been around.
Mm-hmm.
And as I pointed out, my plasma downstairs is now 16, 17 years old. I'm due a refresh as well. Roku OS isn't just the streaming bit, I assume. It is expanded into things like Freeview and FreeSat or whatever the...
Exactly.
Huh.
Yes. So yeah, when you buy a Roku device, all it does is, you know, it connects to your Wi-Fi and it provides some streaming apps. But this is your whole OS for your TV. So it deals with providing the live TV and the guide. It manages your external inputs as well. It manages your picture and sound settings as well. And also it has a physical Ethernet port as well, so it handles connecting to the network via that, not just by Wi-Fi, which is nice.
So what's super about this specific model? Let's say someone had like half a dozen options for TVs. What is good about this thing?
So the things I found interesting about it are, there is, compared to other TVs I've had, there's a massive focus on power consumption and lots of options around optimizing power consumption. Things like it goes to sleep if you don't use it for quite a short period of time, but then it comes back on really quickly. That also applies to the picture settings. The picture settings are low power by default, but you can change them, and you can change them per input. So if you've got different devices which use for different things, like you might want your gaming picture to be something which uses more power to show a better picture, and that can be different from your, I'm just streaming Netflix settings, which can be lower power. You can turn the bloody red LED off as well. it's a 4K screen, which I wasn't sure if I'd have any use for. I've only watched a few things in 4K, but it also upscales very well. So any content you have in other HD resolutions look really good on the screen. They don't look blurry or anything.
I notice you also have in the specs a thing that says pause live TV. Do you actually use it for DVB-T, and do you actually have a signal going into it other than the HDMI from your funky box?
I do have a signal going into it. Unfortunately, our TV aerial's a bit rubbish, so we don't watch a lot of live TV, partly for that reason, but partly just because we mainly stream stuff. But yeah, we do occasionally watch it. I haven't really used the pausing feature. I just thought, when I discovered it, I thought it was quite a neat touch, because there's a USB port on the TV, which you can stick in whatever media and play it if you want to. But all you have to do if you want the pause live TV, because it doesn't have any sort of, you know, storage that you have access to on the device, you just stick in a USB stick, it formats it, and then when you're watching TV, you press pause, and that's all you have to do. It's quite neat.
Yeah, that seems quite a common feature on even the dumbest of smart TVs.
So you mentioned that it's a 4K screen and it upscales well. In life before the event, having, you know, enjoyed cups of tea in your front room, I know that you have a gaming PC under your screen. So how does it, is there any latency when it's upscaling your gaming stuff to 4K?
Well, I have refactored my gaming experience since then. So my gaming PC is now upstairs, and I have a Steam Link plugged into my TV downstairs, and the Steam Link only does 1080p.
Okay. And that upscales fine?
Yes. There's no problem upscaling that at all. I've not noticed anything, any problems at all with that.
I noticed that this television retails for the low, low price of £279. What is rubbish with it? Because that's low for a 43-inch telly in my book.
It is. I was surprised by how well reviewed it was for that amount. So the things that I've noticed are, well, the main thing I've noticed that are bad is the viewing angle. So it's not a problem in my living room, because we have sort of like a cozy nook at the end of the living room where our TV is. So we're not watching from, you know, spread out. But if you go beyond about sort of 90 degrees, the colours wash out quite quickly at that point. So I expect that with a more expensive TV, you'd be able to get quite a lot further out and still be able to see the picture quite well. The other thing I would probably say is, you know, you would probably get better sound with a better TV or with an external sound device. But for our purposes...
Oh, does it actually have speakers?
Oh, it's got speakers, yeah.
Are they rear firing down to the sides, or are they part of the front panel facing you? Or how does that work?
Not the last one.
Right.
But I don't know. All I know is I can hear them. And it does have some really nice sound settings as well. The one that we use most of the time is there's a speech setting, which means that because we watch a lot of, you know, action-y things. The problem we had with our old TV was you'd have people talking like this, and then there'd be a massive explosion, and, you know, so you'd be turning the volume up,
right,
and then you'd be turning the volume
down.
And it was the worst. But the speech thing, it just brings all the speech to the foreground and then just cuts everything else down to a nice manageable volume for you. But, you know, I mean, we have the volume set around 20% and just leave it there, and it's fine. So, you know, I'm not a massive audiophile. I don't need a 5.1 surround system for my purposes. But yeah, it could probably be better if you're into that sort of thing.
The apps that are on board in this Roku thing, is it there's a bunch of apps pre-installed and that's what you get? Or is it like an app? Does it have its own app store where you add apps?
Yeah, so the Roku has its own app store. I think it comes with probably about half a dozen pre-installed, and including like all the Freeview channels, their on-demand services. And then you can install things like Netflix and YouTube. There is a massive library of just like independent streaming services that you can get. And you can also get what they call private channels, which are basically stuff which isn't published in the store. So if there's some service which for whatever reason they wouldn't want to be, or marketed to people, they don't block you from making Roku channels for that. They just don't make it so that you can just go on your device and install them. You have to know the URL to go to, and then you say, give this to my TV, and it does it. Also, Roku devices can sync. So if you install an app on one of your devices and then log on another device, it knows what channels you've got, and then it installs the same ones.
Does it do any kind of continuity of where you got to in a program, or is that down to the apps themselves?
That's down to the apps.
Right.
It's interesting you mentioned private channels. So there's kind of like a Roku homebrew scene, for want of a better description. And there are people that make like derivative versions of like the Plex app. And because it infringes on Plex's trademark, you know, with the logos and everything, they can't be published in the store. But if you add them as like private apps, they've got like enhanced functionality and capabilities and stuff like that. So it's quite interesting to dig into. I've found this fascinating, Mark, because I have been meaning to get a new TV for a couple of years. And like you, I've been utterly dismayed at like the state of smart TVs, and I'm going to have to do one of these. But I do genuinely like the Rokus. They've been fabulous. So a TV that comes with that as the way you have to interface with it, I know is going to have high family acceptance factor.
Yes, I think that's the thing as well. You know, the controller is familiar. It's got extra buttons, but it's got the same controls. And yeah, with the interface looks the same, and it's yeah. I mean, it's running the same apps, so it's cool. I would give it about 8.5 out of 10.
Excellent, sold. I'm going to buy one tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm seriously considering it. Thank you for that, Mark.
And well, if any of you have got a smart TV or a Roku or a Roku TV, then let us know your thoughts. You can email your feedback to show@ubuntupodcast.org. And now, for the first time of the year, it's time for your favourite segment, Command Line Love.
Yes, indeedy. And this one comes from our glorious sponsor, BitFolks, director Andy Smith. I spotted this on his Twitter account. He posted the command, and it's very simple. It's just a dpackage query. So it's really for Debian-based distributions like Ubuntu. And you run this command, and it pipes a bunch of output through a bunch of stuff and tells you a list of the Debian packages that you have installed, sorted by size. That's all it does. And I quite like this because I like having a look at, you know, what's taking up the space on my machine, especially, you know, Debs that I may have installed in the past and completely forgotten about. And I found it super interesting that the things at the top of the list were a couple of things that I've used, but there's a few things in there that I was kind of surprised at.
What were you surprised at then?
I was surprised that the one at the very, very top of the list was Linux firmware.
Right.
Giant bundle of binaries.
Yes.
Many of which I will never, ever use for devices that I'm almost never going to attach to my system. But it needs to be there in case somebody somewhere on the planet does.
I found that
was the thing that I found most fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do too, because, you know, we have lots of people in the Linux desktop community talking about free software and the four freedoms and all of that stuff. And then right there, the biggest package on the system is all of these blobs that make all of your hardware function.
I've got a couple of browsers there. I've got Brave and Google Chrome.
Yes.
Firefox is in there. You've got Edge, have you?
Yeah, Edge was at the top of my list, yeah.
Libwine. I've got two copies of Libwine in there. Mm-hmm. VirtualBox.
I don't have that.
Thunderbird, the email client.
Yeah.
I have something called Open Audible. I can't remember what on earth that is, but I have that. And a whole bunch of Linux kernel modules.
Yeah. That's, I've got a massive list of Linux kernel modules for various versions of the kernel, which I probably don't have anymore.
Yeah, I've got multiple versions of LLVM, different revisions of that. They seem to be quite chunky. And also, yeah. I found at some point I'd installed the free Pascal compiler, which I had no need for anymore, and that was massive. So I yanked that out as a result of running this.
Well, that's the thing. It is actually quite interesting because you could like reclaim a bit of disk space by getting rid of not random packages, but you know, if you have a good think about where these packages have come from and look at the package description, you can maybe figure out whether you need to get rid of them. But like you said, Mark, there's a bunch of kernel module packages for kernels I'm definitely not running anymore. And maybe auto remove might help me get rid of some of those. But also, apt remove a few of those, mm-hmm. but keep a lookout for the output of the apt remove command, because it will tell you if it's going to remove a bunch of other stuff as well. Mm. And, you know, danger, Will Robinson, don't remove stuff that you don't know what it is.
Great. And that's all the command line love. And now it's time for your wonderful feedback. And while we were off, Ian Forbes emailed us to show@ubuntupodcast.org.
I hope you get to have your curry, albeit remotely, and would just like to say I hope you keep the podcast going in its current format. It's a welcome distraction from all the current tomfoolery and the best £3 I spend each month.
Aww.
That's very kind. Surely the recent spike in Bitcoin means that crypto billionaire Wimpress has no more material needs and can thus dedicate more time to the podcast, surfing and going to the casino at Monte Carlo. Ian, you are so funny. I hadn't read that sentence until just now. Thank you, Ian. Yes, indeed, we did have a socially distanced by approximately 60 miles curry a few weeks ago, and here we are. We obviously decided to do this again. And Ian says that he spends £3, and this is true. So we ask some of our listeners to support us, if you're able, on Patreon. And the money raised there, we use to pay Joe Ressington for professional podcast services. So we're at the start of a new season. We're not going to do this very often, but if you do enjoy the podcast, do consider contributing something there so we can do the bit that we enjoy doing, which is talking to you, and not the bit that we don't enjoy doing, which is editing and processing audio.
That we're also not especially good at.
Well, yes, also true.
There is that too. Yes. And if you aren't able to give a regular donation, but you do want to offer some support, you can also do a one-off donation via PayPal. And I think you can find the details at ubuntupodcast.org/donate. And Andy Williams emailed us.
Hey, Alan, I just wanted to reach out and say I think the cabin proposal you and Stuart came up with is a brilliant idea. I'm not a programmer, but I wanted to mention it. It fills a void that Linux needs more of. Android and iOS are what they are today because of the app development environment. The more ways people can whip up some little graphical wrappers around even command line utilities would go far. I'm more likely to use something that has an icon and opens a graphical user interface. I searched for Ubuntu repos for graphical apps to find. Pretty hit and miss, but either way, I like the idea. That's very kind of you to say, Andy. Thank you for the feedback.
And finally, Jonathan Cox emailed us.
Sorry for treating you guys like lazy Google here, but are there any roadblocks preventing snaps of proprietary games, such as the installer for Unreal Tournament? No content, of course. The game data would need to be provided by your Steam CMD or GOG. But what are your guys' thoughts on this? Well, I have an opinion, but maybe Alan wants to answer first.
I mean, it is done. There are snaps in the store which actually do exactly this, which download binaries which are freely licensed, but there are assets that you need to provide. And a good example is the one that I did, Core6TH, Theme Hospital. So long as you go and mm-hmm. buy Theme Hospital, or you've got a copy that you had in the past and you put it in the right place, then the snap of Core6TH can find it, and you can play Theme Hospital in 4K on your modern machine. So yeah, that is a thing that we do.
I've seen. I think there's Red Alert as well. Mm. Somebody's done, which is obviously an implementation of the game engine, and you provide the game assets after the fact, and it will play the game. And a while back, you and I, Alan, we did Trackmania, which is actually a Windows game, and it's free to play. And all we did was stand up like this Wine environment inside a Snap, and the first time you run it, it goes and downloads the game and installs it into a user writable area, so it doesn't actually distribute the game itself.
Yeah, we try and be careful with that kind of stuff, but it's certainly something you could do, but there's a balance to be made, because some people might install it and expect it to work out of the box. And so you have to set the expectations and let people know when they're going to install it, what they're installing is an installer or is a binary only thing that you need to provide some additional stuff. So long as the expectations are set, yeah, and you're adhering to whatever the third-party proprietary software license is, then, and redistribution terms, then yeah, I think it's perfectly reasonable.
And that is all of your wonderful feedback for this week. And that's all for episode 2. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email show@ubuntupodcast.org. And if you want to come and chat to us in the friendliest place on the internet, you can find us in our Telegram channel at ubuntupodcast.org/telegram. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.